Today I'm going to tell you about one of the themes that we are thinking about in the gravitational holography program. And that theme is the following title. It's about the unreasonable effectiveness of semi-classical gravity. The context of this talk is ADS-CFT. It's about how semi-classical physics in the ADS spacetime seems to know more than it ought to about what happens in the CFT. To make life simple, this talk is going to be mostly about the sort of simplest version of the holography, one in where the bulk is in two dimensions and the boundary is just one dimension, just time. This observation sort of comes about in many contexts. A few things which I will not cover in this talk, but you should definitely go read about, is, for example, quantum chaos, how semi-classical scattering of shock waves in the bulk or out-of-time ordered shock waves realizes this idea, in a black hole background, that's key, gives you maximal possible chaos or maximal growth for out-of-time ordered correlation functions in the CFT. Another interesting thing is quantum teleportation, where in the bulk, quantum teleportation is manifested as information traversing a wormhole. These are interesting topics, which I will not be able to talk about today. The focus for this talk is going to be on entanglement entropy and the information paradox. How much we can say about these things by working purely in the semi-classical limit. So to begin, let me introduce this concept of holographic entanglement entropy, which is how to compute the entropy of the boundary using the bulk. The thing that we want to compute, say for example, let's consider starting with vacuum ADS, and at some point we insert a shock wave, some energy into the bulk, some shell of matter that collapses and forms a black hole. Now, black holes are going to be center stage in this talk. This is due to some pure state on the CFT. Now suppose this CFT, I'm going to call it R. Suppose we want to compute the entropy of the CFT at some given time, say here. The way you compute entropy is you evaluate trace rho log rho, okay? Just the standard von Neumann entropy. But there's a interesting formula that computes this entropy using the bulk, which is first proposed by Ryu and Takinagi, and then further refined by, for example, Faulkner, Lokutz, Maldacena, Engelhardt, and Wall, and proved by others. What this formula says is that to compute the entropy of the boundary R, what you should do is first consider a surface, a co-dimension 2 surface, X, in the bulk, and consider the following functional evaluated using that surface. The first term in this functional is the area of this point, or the second term in this functional is the von Neumann entropy of the region bounded by X and R. Now, what are these symbols here? So far I haven't told you what fixes X. What fixes the location of X is what this symbol stands for. This stands for extremization. So what you should do is take this functional, which let me define as Sgen, this is called the generalized entropy, and look for locations in the bulk such that this functional is extremized. Okay, the first order variation of this functional is equal to zero. Often you will find that there are many extrema in the bulk, surfaces that satisfy this. In that case, what you should do is take the one with the minimal generalized entropy, with the minimal value of this functional. I forgot to say that please interrupt me if you have any questions. A surface which extremizes the generalized entropy is called a quantum extremal surface. I'm going to be saying this phrase many, many times in this talk. Let me write it down. Okay, let's apply this formula in our case here. So here we had a pure state of the CFT. Therefore, the entropy should be zero. But there's something weird about this formula. It has an area term which is positive and an entropy term which is positive, so it seems like you'll never get zero. But the secret is that one of these surfaces, or a possible extremal surface, is what is called the trivial surface. Basically, the no surface. In that case, let's draw it here. In that case, the region sigma XR becomes simply a Cauchy slice of the bulk. So in the case of the trivial state or the trivial surface, the entropy of R will simply be the von Neumann entropy of the region sigma Cauchy. And assuming that the bulk matter fields are, or the matter here is in a pure state, this thing will give zero. Okay? Any questions about that? Okay. Now, something I'm going to, this might be a bit weird, but what I want to do now is I want to allow this black hole to evaporate. This is a black hole inside of ADS. ADS is like a big sort of confining box. What this means is that the Hawking radiation coming out of this black hole will simply reflect off the boundary and fall back in. So the black hole is in equilibrium with its own Hawking radiation. But suppose we introduce an external system, which I call the bath. Here I'm drawing sort of a half Minkowski space, which I have glued to the CFT here. So you should think of this as, if you ignore sort of the bulk for a second and think of this in terms of the boundary description, I have a CFT, which is living here, coupled to sort of a semi-infinite bath. And at the same time, when we couple these two things together, what we mean is that we're imposing some sort of transparent boundary conditions on this boundary. This means that Hawking radiation emitted by the black hole will not get reflected and will escape into this external system. So I'm going to call the bath B. Suppose that the combined state, the boundary R and the bath B, are in a pure state. If they're in a pure state, then the von Neumann entropy of the union of B and R is equal to zero. This implies that the entropy of R is equal to the entropy of B. And now we can write down the entropy of B is equal to the same thing as the entropy of R, which I will write down in a somewhat suggestive way. So it's equal to the area of the surface X divided by 4g Newton plus the entropy now of the region bath union I, where bath union I is the complement of this region. This is I, and this is B. So this generalized entropy functional here is identical to this functional, where I'm simply expressing things in terms of the complement of the regions that I was just considering. It'll be convenient to write x here as the boundary of I. As you can see, the location x is the boundary of I. And rewrite the extremization and the minimization as extremizing over the regions I and minimizing over the possible extremal regions I. Okay. So this formula is the same as this formula. I've just re-expressed it in terms of other quantities. Now this says something crazy. This says that if I have some, you can think of B here as simply the Hawking radiation coming out of the black hole. This says that when you compute the entropy of the Hawking radiation, you should include contributions coming from possible regions I, or what we called islands. Okay? And they come in this way, and they have to be taken into account when computing the entropy. Any question about that? Okay. The goal for the rest of this talk is to apply these formulas to various different contexts and be surprised at their results. I will discuss a possible way to prove these formulas at the end of the talk, if I have time. Okay, so let's consider the first case, which is the eternal black hole. So the eternal black hole looks something like this. Here I have two asymptotic boundaries, or two CFTs, and they're prepared in what is called a thermal field double state, which is an entangled state between the two CFTs. Often the eternal black hole is described as a wormhole. One way to see that is that if you look at a slice here, then the geometry of the slice looks something like this. Okay. Where this point in the middle called the bifurcation surface is simply the part of the neck which has the smallest circumference. Okay. Now let's apply this formula to compute the entropy of, say, the right boundary. So this is an entangled state. There's an entanglement entropy between the two boundaries. So just take this functional, extremize it, and so on, and you'll land at the this bifurcation surface. You will find that the entropy of R is simply given by the area of the horizon divided by 4 g Newton plus the bulk entropy of this region. Let me call this location HR. It's interesting to note that this answer is precisely equal to the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of the black hole, which at least as originally sort of proposed, this entropy computes for you the coarse-grained entropy of the black hole. So it's like a thermodynamic entropy of the black hole. But in this case, in this special situation, the fine-grained entropy, right? We're computing a trace rho log rho. This is a fine-grained entropy. It's equal to the coarse-grained entropy, and that's not a surprise, because if you compute the density matrix of the right-hand side, so let's say rho r, you'll find that it's precisely equal to the thermal density matrix. Okay? That's not a surprise. We can also apply this to not just the entropy of R, but the entropy of the union of L and R. So let's do that. So L plus R. And now there are two possible sort of candidates for surfaces that compute the entropy. One is, looks something like this. So, so the union of these two surfaces, or one that connects the two boundaries. We already saw sort of what happens. Well, we talked about the trivial surface here. This is a contribution from the trivial surface. There is no endpoint, so there's no area term. And this is what we need because the state of the left and the right is a pure state, so the entropy should be zero. So here SLR is equal to S of the Cauchy surface, this entire thing, which is equal to zero. Note that this is not equal to the coarse grain entropy. Which is equal to SL plus SR, which is twice the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. I gave this example just to sort of convince you that this formula is computing something which is more fine-grained. So it gives you zero, while the coarse-grained entropy is something large. Any questions about that? Okay. The next thing I'm going to talk about is this notion in ADS-CFT, which is called subregion duality. It's an answer to the question of which part of the bulk of this ADS spacetime can be reconstructed from which part of the boundary. Okay. And the answer really is provided by this formula. Let's take, for example, let's look at this diagram. And let's take a, let me first make a statement. So from this formula, the fact that SR contains S sigma HR tells you that the boundary R, or the density matrix of R, is sensitive to what you do in this region. For example, say I put a spin here in some mixed state. And if I compute the entropy of R, I will get a contribution log 2 from the spin. Therefore, this boundary region R is sensitive to the spin. And then you can go through some more precise arguments to show that really everything in this region is in R. What do I mean by that? I mean that for any operator, let's call it phi, on the region sigma HR, the action of this operator on the state, Thermofield double, is equal to, there exists an operator purely on R, which does the exact same thing. this is the statement of subregion-subregion duality. So you have a bulk operator acting here. You can find an operator on the boundary that does the exact same thing, which is supported purely on R. And this really follows from this statement here. It follows from this formula. So, in some sense, this formula has in it sort of an element of holography. Right? Holography is a statement about how the bulk physics is encoded on the boundary. And this formula tells you that it is indeed encoded in this way. Okay. Any questions at this point?
Do you require that OR be a unitary operator?
If phi is unitary, then I would require OR to be unitary. At least when acting within some subspace. I want a more precise statement. Okay. Next, I will talk about the eternal black hole again, but now one that is coupled to the external path. In the same way that I outlined at the beginning. So the spacetime I'm going to draw is the following. So here's the eternal black hole. And now I'm going to join two external half-space regions where the Hawking radiation can now escape. I'm imagining that these two systems are coupled for all time. But now you might say, but hang on, if they're coupled for all time and this is a black hole, the radiation is going to escape and the black hole is going to shrink. The way you fix that is that you set the state up such that you have Hawking radiation, or you have radiation coming in, balancing out the radiation that's going out. Okay? So this is it's an eternal black hole that is eternally coupled to these external systems. This should be thought of as a toy model for asymptotically flat black holes. Okay.
Question.
Yes.
Can you always patch hub spaces like this to ADS, or is it for ADS2 only?
I don't see an obstruction to doing it in general, but the case that we studied was just in two dimensions. Okay. Now let's do everything we did for the eternal black hole, but now for this modified eternal black hole. Let's compute the entropy of R. Okay, what you find, so the thing that we need to do is look for a quantum extremal surface. So we need to do this, again, this procedure of putting an x there, and we have sigma xr here. And we have to move this x around to find the quantum extreme, or to find the extremal surface or the quantum extremal surface. And the surprise that you find is that while in this case the quantum extremal surface went all the way to the horizon, in this case the quantum extremal surface actually lies outside of the horizon, somewhere here. And this actually has very important consequences. Okay, so the first statement is that the quantum extremal surface is outside. It's also, so even though it's outside, it's actually very near the bifurcate horizon, or this point here, it's very close to the horizon. Therefore, the entropy of R is actually still very close to the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. Okay? Moreover, because of the Bose symmetry in this space-time, so there's a symmetry of moving these points around in this way, this entropy is actually, it's equal to this, and it's constant for all time. The most surprising thing about this result is that it gives you a picture for how this boundary system forgets about information that is thrown into it. So here I have the bound region R, and the bath on this side is called the bath, right? So these two things are coupled together for all time. You imagine that if I sort of insert some information into this space-time, so this information is contained in R initially. At some point, this information should escape R. So R should forget about this information. Basically because it's sort of exchanging degrees of freedom with the bath. And the bulk manifestation of that is that at some later time, the quantum extremal surface only goes up to there. Okay? So while at this time, the information is contained inside sort of sigma XR in using this statement here, this means that the information is contained in R. At some later time, it escapes and it's no longer contained in this region. And therefore you see that the information is not contained in R anymore. So that's one surprise. The other surprise is the following. You can ask, how much time in the past do I need to send the information in so that by that time the boundary system R has forgotten about the information? So what is this delta T F for forget? So you find that this delta TF is precisely equal to what is known as the scrambling time. Or SR, let's say. There's a minor thing here. This is not completely honest, but I'll leave the experts to worry about that. But you find that after a time which goes as the log of the entropy, the boundary region R completely forgets about the information that was thrown into it. And it really, well, semi-classical physics really has no right to know about this timescale, about when the information escapes. This timescale was predicted by, or rather, let me say that the setup realizes a proposal of Hayden and Preskill for how fast a black hole should forget about information. The way that they motivated their proposal was the following. They said, suppose we consider a black hole let's ignore the box for a second. Suppose we consider a black hole represented by these four qubits, okay, that is maximally entangled with some external system, which is like the Hawking radiation, say. The entanglement is represented by these lines. And then they asked, what if I send a message, psi, into this black hole, which I allow to scramble with the black hole degrees of freedom? This box is like a unitary transformation acting on all of these qubits. And they took this unitary transformation to be a local, but it's a local circuit on these qubits, but it's all to all, meaning that it's a sum of local terms coupling any two qubits at a time. And what they showed first was, if you wait for a sufficiently long time here, then if you take one of these qubits out, there actually exists a decoding operation or decoding unitary, which can extract the state psi out again. They found that for such local and all-to-all circuits, the time scale that you need here goes as log n, where n is the number of qubits of the black hole. Okay, so this is a purely quantum information theoretic argument, and tells you that for such circuits, you need to wait a scrambling time, log n time, for you to be able to extract the message, having sort of taken just a small subsystem of the black hole, combining it with the thing the black hole is entangled with. And
the time of the circuit is a number of operations.
Correct. Yes. It's a number of operations, but now you need to put a time scale, and so you need to put beta. That's the way, the usual way you phrase it. And that's realized in this picture. And it's, to me, that's very, very surprising. It sort of, it fits, I guess it kind of fits with this thing that I didn't talk about, the quantum chaos, that black holes are sort of the most chaotic things in nature. And it's, the scrambling time also does come out in that discussion. It sort of tells you that the black hole dynamics can, I guess, simply be represented by a scrambling circuit. Maybe I should just stop there.
That's quite interesting. It's as short as log n.
Yes, exactly. Okay. That's, I think I said everything I want to say about this point. Now let me switch gears to computing the entropy of another system, which is going to be the union of the bats. So let me leave that here. I'm going to erase this guy. Any questions about what I said so far? Yes.
So when you say the information is lost at the later time that you drew there, you mean that the perturbation is no longer, at that time, you mean the perturbation is no longer inside the causal diamond of the...
It's no longer, well, I should have defined something. So this region, sigma HR, is called the entanglement wedge, let's say. Well, it's really a slice of it. And the point that I'm making is that the excitation is no longer inside the entanglement wedge of R.
Right. So that would be equivalent to considering the causal diamond. Okay. By entanglement wedge, you mean the two-dimensional volume, right?
Yes. Let me say one more thing about this. We can try to contrast this with the case that I just erased. Let me draw it again. You can ask, well, say I send information from the right here, which falls into the black hole. Well, the information falls into the black hole. Don't I lose the information in R? The answer is no, because this entanglement wedge of R, or this sigma, goes all the way to the horizon. So no matter sort of at any time, the information about the message is always contained on this slice sigma. So this tells you that the information is always in R. It's never lost to R. And that makes sense here, because R is not coupled to anything else. So whatever information you throw into R should stay there for all time. Okay? All right. So the next thing I want to consider is computing the entropy of BL plus BR, which I will define as B. Okay. This region is the following. So let's consider our space-time again. This region is given by these two half spaces. And you should think of this as computing the entropy or these two regions, they are a they represent the Hawking radiation of the black hole, or rather the outgoing Hawking radiation. Okay.
Why is it just outgoing? You just said there's lots of incoming radiation to maintain this static black hole.
Fine. Just the Hawking radiation of the black hole. Well, would you call that Hawking radiation?
No.
I think incoming?
Incoming stuff is stuff you throw in.
Okay.
Just radiation.
So then you would say, then you just say outgoing Hawking radiation plus incoming radiation. Yes, you can think of it like that. And so let's talk about computing the entropy of B. First, let me give you sort of the goal is to apply this formula, okay, to this case. The first thing we should consider is, what does a trivial surface imply? So the trivial surface, this means it's the case with no island. So when we compute the entropy of B, it is simply going to be the entropy of the region sigma B, which is this thing, the union of these two guys. Okay? And we want to compute this as a function of time, where by time here, I mean you evolve both endpoints forwards in time. Okay, and let's plot what this entropy looks like as a function of time. So S, B. What you find is that the entropy simply grows, and it grows linearly in time for all time. And there's a very easy way to explain why that happens. The reason is the following. So there's Hawking radiation coming out of this black hole. There are modes like this that are entangled with modes like that. And also on the other side, but let me ignore those. And as a function of time, as you evolve this point to the future, you collect more and more Hawking radiation, and therefore you build up more and more entanglement. You keep collecting these guys, which are entangled with their partners behind the horizon, and that's why the entropy continues to grow. The reason why it grows linearly, first I should say that it's proportional to the temperature T times time. This black hole is an eternal black hole, and therefore its mass is constant, and therefore its temperature is constant, and this is the rate at which it produces these entangled pairs. It goes something like that. And this is, what we reproduced so far is what Stephen Hawking, it's sort of Stephen Hawking's calculation for the entropy of radiation coming out of a black hole. By just considering the Hawking radiation coming out, he found that the entropy continues to grow. In his case, it was until the black hole evaporates away completely. In our case, the black hole is always there, and therefore it just grows indefinitely. The statement of the information paradox is that there's an upper bound to this entropy. The point being is that the amount of entanglement between the radiation and the black hole should not exceed the coarse-grained entropy of the black hole, which we computed here, which is just equal to twice the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. Okay, the thing that we learn about black holes is that they're finite dimensional sort of systems, and they have a maximum amount of entropy that they can have. But what Hawking shows is that the entanglement seems to exceed that, and that's a statement of the information paradox. But so far we just analyzed the trivial surface. What about the non-trivial surface, the one with an island? In this case, we should include a contribution coming from an island which we find to situate itself somewhere there. So here, the entropy is going to be the area of the boundaries of I plus the entropy of the union of B and I. And this, let me see if it's going to be clear. Let me tell you the result first. What you find for this result is that first the islands are, again, they're very close to the horizon in the same way that in this case the entropy was very close to the horizon. And since there are two endpoints, one finds precisely this result of twice the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. And you find that the answer is simply more or less constant with time for all time. So we have there's a contribution coming from the island, which gives us constant peace. And we have a contribution coming from the no island, which gives us growing peace. To get the actual entropy of B, there's one more ingredient that we need to take into account, which is the minimality constraint, which says that you look again for all the quantum extremal surfaces, or the quantum extremal islands in this case, and then take the one with the smallest entropy. While doing that, you land on an entropy that has the following behavior as a function of time. So the entropy of the radiation grows up until it hits the coarse grain entropy, and then it saturates. And all of this comes from this formula. This behavior, or this curve, is famously known as the Page curve. The surprise here is that a formula which is applicable within the semi-classical limit gives you an answer which is beyond the semi-classical limit, if you will. It fixes Hawking's answer. Any question about that? Yes?
This is to just play devil's advocate, but I mean, it seems like you picked the rule that gives you the right answer, not derived the rule that gives you the right answer from semi-classical limit.
Yep. My next step was to prove the rule. Questions?
So since the black hole is not evaporating, there's incoming radiation from the past. But as your surface moves up towards the future, less and less of that incoming radiation is intercepted on that surface. So I'm just wondering why we don't need to consider that contribution to the entropy.
I'm not sure I followed which contribution you meant.
So there's incoming thermal radiation,
mm-hmm.
Right? And as time goes on with your slice, yeah, exactly.
That the island moves forward.
Pardon?
The island moves upwards. I don't know if that.
The island. Yeah.
It's taken into account. Yeah.
So as I move these endpoints forwards in time, the island correspondingly moves forwards in time as well.
Let me clarify. What I'm saying is, if I don't consider the incoming radiation, it's clear why I would think the entropy would increase with time, like you drew that linear. But on the other hand, if I include the incoming radiation, that part of the entropy is going down with time, it looks like. So I'm just puzzled by that. Why are we not thinking about that?
It's also increasing.
Yeah, it's also increasing. Even the incoming. Okay. Let me see. You're talking about this. Let me use a different color. Ed, I think you're talking about this mode being entangled with a mode over here, say. So. So this slice here?
Yeah, I forgot that the two thermal sides were actually pure when taken together.
Exactly.
That they were entangled.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Okay. The thing that buys you sort of a lot of entropy, the thing that reduces the entropy by a lot, is the fact that this piece here, this is the entropy of the union of the bath and the island. So whatever large amount of entanglement that you had between this region and this region, that doesn't count anymore when computing the entropy of the bath, right? They purify each other, and that's why you don't get a very large contribution here. Okay, so the last thing I'm going to say, how much time do I have? Okay.
5 minutes.
Okay. So the last thing is going to be about deriving this rule. Which is the following. This space-time can be obtained via a Euclidean path integral, which also on the following space-time, or Euclidean space-time, in the region outside here, I have a quantum field theory. Well, actually, secretly, I was working with a conformal field theory. And inside this region here, I have gravity plus conformal field theory. Okay, so this is a path integral, which if I sort of consider the Euclidean black hole here and consider a slice like that and continue that slice to Lorentzian time, I will get this space-time. So this is the usual story that many of you know about. But now I want to use this Euclidean path integral to compute the entropy of a region which is purely in the bath like that. Okay, so this region, the union of these two, I'm gonna call it B. The density matrix. So to compute the entropy again, it's trace rho log rho. But the way to do that, convenient way to compute the entropy, is by the so-called replica trick, which is to first compute trace rho to the n of the region B, and then take n goes to 1. Okay, this is called the replica trick. To do this, we first need to we need to know how to get the density matrix. So rho B, AA prime, these are sort of the matrix elements, are prepared via this path integral with these boundary conditions on the top of this slice and on the bottom. So these A and A prime represent the states. The thing we need to compute is trace rho to the n of B, which means that you should consider multiple copies of this space-time, but now identified across the region B, and so on. So they're identified cyclically. So if you go in here, you come out there, and you go in here, you come out there, and so on and so forth. So this gives you that. But what this thing actually is, it's the evaluation of the full path integral on this replicated geometry. In these regions, you're evaluating the CFT path integral, while in these regions, you're evaluating the gravitational path integral along with the CFT path integral. This means that you should allow for all gravitational configurations that are allowed by the sort of boundary conditions in this manifold. And you find that there are two important saddle point contributions to this path integral. The first, which I'm going to call the Hawking saddle. Where each gravitational region here is filled in with a Euclidean black hole, and so on. The other possible contribution comes from wormholes connecting the different gravitational regions. And I'm going to draw the wormhole for a specific case where n is equal to 3. This time looks like this. The wormhole connects the different sheets in this way. Okay? I'm going to call this saddle point the wormhole saddle. You can imagine now collapsing all of these spacetimes into a single sheet. So you can work in what is called a branched cover. And you find that trace rho to the n of b has a contribution coming from something that looks like this. So this is the Hawking saddle, plus a contribution. We'll draw this a bit big so we can see what happens, where this wormhole connecting the different sheets represents itself here as a new branch cut and branch points, but now in the gravitational region. Okay? So these wormholes generate for you a new branch cut and branch points, which you can think of sort of as dynamically generated. And now you can sort of see where the island formula comes from. The fact that you have a new branch cut here, it tells you that the entropy that you're computing now gets a contribution from a new region, the region being here. So let's call this region is what I've been calling I, and the union of these regions is what I've been calling B. So here the entropy is simply the entropy of B, while here, because of these three cuts, it's the entropy of B union I. There's another thing which I didn't get a chance to explain, but it's now understood that if you have branch points in a theory of gravity, that generates for you area terms. So this becomes the area of the boundary of I divided by 4g Newton. Okay? So we see how a different saddle point of trace rho to the n can generate for you something like the island formula. And to the last equation I'm going to write down, when working near n equals 1, trace rho b to the n is roughly equal to e to the minus n minus 1 times the Hawking answer plus e to the minus n minus 1 times the island answer. This is what trace rho to the n looks like. I've only considered just two contributions coming from two different saddle points, but in principle there are many more terms. And the point now is, as a function of time, we saw that the Hawking entropy keeps growing. Therefore, e to the minus the Hawking entropy goes down. So this contribution goes to zero, while this contribution remains constant, because, as I said, that the island entropy piece gives you a constant entropy. And therefore, you have this competition between these exponentially small terms in computing trace rho to the n, and there's a first-order phase transition between these two saddle points, and that's how you get the page curve. So let me stop there.
Yes. So you have quantum gravity in this circular region. So I would think that you have to integrate over these branch points, otherwise you're breaking on the same piece. So what is the meaning of this region I when you do that?
Good. So, yes, in principle you integrate over them, but we're looking for a saddle point. So there's a saddle in that integral, and that's the thing that ultimately amounts to this extremization condition. Yes?
Hi. In your last argument, was it important that the region where you have B has no gravity, how would it change your island formula derivation if it had gravity?
Good. So, so I view this as an advantage that there's no gravity, because when you have gravity, it's kind of ambiguous what you mean by the entropy of a given region, right? But now in this part of the space-time, the metric is just fixed, and therefore defining the entropy of a region makes sense. The thing that can happen is, the space-time can fluctuate. You're integrating over different geometries and so on, and that's what I mean by it becomes ambiguous. But in this case, you've restricted the region of space-time with a space where you're integrating over the metrics. So that's how that's the advantage of doing this.
So is this space in addition some kind of reflection of Noether invariance, a little bit like in 3D gravity, both integration transition can be viewed as a reflection of phase transition between
it's the same. It's the same phenomenon. I agree. And then you just have these. The first order phase transition.
Yes. In equals to 3 case, do you consider geometries where there's a wormhole connecting two of them and the third one is disconnected?
Good. So these are called replica symmetry breaking configurations. So here, there's a symmetry here. I can just rotate this. We don't include those. Those are hard to compute in this model. But there's another model studied by a group at Stanford, where they can actually consider all of these replica symmetry breaking configurations, and all they do is that they smoothen out this corner here. What happens is that this thing just goes to something like that.
Yes, it's like other.